Hi, everybody, and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of this particular show, which is New Books in Big Ideas. Today we have Rick Sander and Stuart Taylor on the show, and we'll be talking about their book, Mismatch, How Affirmative Action Hurts Students, It's Intended to Help, and Why Universities Won't Admit It. So what are the big ideas in this book?
Well, Marshall, thanks for having us on and arranging this.
My pleasure.
Like a nice project. I think there are three big ideas in the book. The first one is that we think that controversial social policies often need to be evaluated in terms of data, rather than in terms of ideologies and emotions. Affirmative action is a good example because it's been passionately debated for over 30 years, but most of the debate has been locked in a fairly narrow range where one side says justice requires that we compensate minorities for harms of the past and use preferences, and the other side says no, we're now in an era of equality, we need to treat everybody the same. And our approach in the book is to say, well, both of those things are somewhat true, but let's see how this program actually works. Let's see what it actually does. So the book is largely about trying to define how affirmative action and racial preferences operate in higher education today and what the effects are. The second big idea is that to a very surprising degree, large racial preferences tend to hurt the recipients more than they help them. So for example, students who finish high school and want to become scientists generally will go to a good school. Generally, they'll go to the best school that will admit them, and they'll study their program. But in the case of minorities who receive large preferences, that will end up putting them at a school where they're surrounded by people with stronger academic preparation, because the preferences that universities use are extremely large, especially for African-Americans and American Indians. So research shows that when students take a large preference, go to a competitive institution, and try to major in the sciences or engineering, they have extremely high attrition rates. Only about 10 or 15% end up getting a degree in the field that they want to. So that's just an example of how preferences can be counterproductive. The third big idea is that universities and higher education generally has sort of a culture of denial about the effects of affirmative action. Even though there's a mounting pile of evidence on these issues, it's been accumulating for almost 20 years, universities tend to ignore it. They don't want to talk about it. They don't want to provide data on what their actual outcomes are. And frequently they foster an environment that demonizes anybody who does ask these questions. So altogether, these things mean that we have a very healthy, very unhealthy environment about affirmative action dialogue. And it makes it really hard to improve and reform those programs.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for that. Stuart, would you add anything to that?
Yes, Rick covered it very well, but I always like to add a little something. First, I'd like to emphasize, I think we would both emphasize, that when we talk about affirmative action, we're in favor of affirmative action if it's understood as it was originally defined by Presidents Kennedy and Johnson, as meaning especially active efforts to help racial minorities and other disadvantaged people. At the time, most racial minorities were disadvantaged. That's not so true now. Get a fair start in life. Racial preferences are what affirmative action has come to mean, as that phrase is usually used. Racial preferences typically today operate by taking fairly well-off members of minority groups and giving them extra SAT points, essay grade point averages, giving them a preference in admissions in the universities over white and Asian students who are often less well-off economically. And so I want to emphasize that we're in favor of that old kind of affirmative action. We're in favor, and our book explicitly advocates affirmative action for socioeconomically disadvantaged people. Mm-hmm. Number two, I just mentioned the types of harms Rick started, that we think the current racial preference regime does to the recipients of the preferences, particularly black preferences, black recipients of preferences. Apart from having trouble completing science courses for kids who wanted to be scientists and who would have succeeded in being scientists if they went to schools for which they were well prepared. Their low grades go down. Graduation rates go down. There's a very high bar exam failure rate and also failure rates on medical boards for good black students and other minority students who are placed with super qualified white students and who are not able to compete. And also, there's a loss of intellectual self-confidence that comes from being clustered at the bottom of the class and seeing that other people who look like you are clustered that way. It reinforces racial stereotypes of the worst kind. It reinforces the internalization of stereotypes of black intellectual inferiority by the supposed beneficiaries of preferences. And as Rick said, the culture of denial is very, very powerful, and I think it extends to and includes the universities of America, the selective universities, I think systematically misleading their racial preference recruits by suggesting that they're going to do very well academically when the universities know that most of them will not do well academically.
Mm-hmm. Thank you both for that summary. And before we go on to talk about the particulars of the book, I want to make two things completely clear to the listeners. I will characterize this and you can assent or adjust this. So your argument is not against affirmative action per se. That's A. And then B, it is not based on fairness. That is, your criticism of affirmative action are not based on fairness or unfairness.
That's right. I mean, we have views about the fairness. And, mm-hmm. and as Stuart mentioned, we do think it's unfair that the current preference regime is very skewed towards people who are quite affluent.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we think it's unfair when racial preferences don't distinguish between African Americans and African immigrants or mixed race folks.
Mm-hmm.
If an Hispanic preference extends to somebody who's only 1/8 Hispanic, I mean there are lots of genuine fairness issues, I think, involved in any kind of affirmative action that looks primarily to race as it currently operates.
Mm-hmm. Right. I guess what I meant to say was that your criticism of affirmative action as currently configured is, to put it very bluntly, it doesn't do what we want it to. It is not effective.
Right.
Yeah.
It's empirically driven, and it's saying if you look at the stated goals and you look at what's actually happening, there's a huge gap, and we need to cross that gap.
Mm-hmm. Stuart, do you want to add anything to that?
I agree with Rick. I don't dismiss the traditional fairness argument. You know, the traditional fairness argument from the anti-racial preference side is it's unfair to take black students and jump them over white students who are equally or better qualified. We're not doing that argument again. That argument's going on for a long time, and people aren't changing their minds on it. That's why we're emphasizing the empirical evidence that shows it doesn't work, while sort of taking an agnostic position on the traditional fairness argument that has dominated debate on this subject.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the real strengths of the book. Maybe we could talk a little bit. I'm a historian by training, and one of the most interesting things to me in the book occurs right actually at the beginning, and that is the discovery of what you call the mismatch effect. How was it discovered?
Well, there were two stages. I think conceptually, some people who looked at the system back in the late 1960s, as soon as large racial preferences started, were concerned about what was going to happen. Christopher Jenks, for example, is not often mentioned as a critic of preferences in this context, but he wrote a book called The Academic Revolution, David Riesman, and I think it was 1969. It's a very influential book at the time, and it wasn't a major theme, but when they talked about sort of current policies to increase diversity, they noted that mismatch could be a real issue. Thomas Sowell, prominent black conservative critic, laid out the whole problem of mismatch in the early 1970s. So I think thoughtful observers who were willing to speak candidly saw that this could potentially be a really serious problem.
Mm-hmm.
But there was very little data, and universities tended to hide what data could be found. So there was very little empirical research on this until the 1990s. But during that time, I think again, more people who were concerned about this started gathering anecdotal information and became more convinced that there really was an issue. So in the mid-1990s, a few different people started doing research on this. One of the best studies was by Roger Zellian, a psychologist at Dartmouth. And he hypothesized that there would be a mismatch problem, and he convinced a number of Ivy League institutions that they should cooperate on a study of how minorities did in science fields and why there was this very high minority attrition problem. He didn't couch it as a mismatch study, which was probably why the other institutions agreed to give him data. And he created a pretty good database and found very strong evidence that the degree of attrition at these schools was very closely linked to essentially the admissions preference those students had received when they came in. So that started the process, and I think if universities had been receptive to this and had sort of dealt with it in a forthright way, then I think within 4 or 5 years, we would have had very widespread documentation, a strong consensus that there were problems that needed to be addressed. But the leading works from official figures like Derek Bach and William Bowen's book, The Shape of the River, simply ignored the evidence that Rogers Elliott had put together and sort of presented misleading evidence that suggested that there weren't any problems in this area. So that's caused the development of this idea to be almost like guerrilla warfare, where professors who see this as a problem struggle to get data, publish results, and then frequently deal with an academy where it simply is considered politically incorrect to endorse that research.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I know from my personal experience that universities are not very excited about releasing data on outcomes. They don't like it at all. And Stuart, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, one figure who I think deserves a mention here in terms of early warnings about mismatch problems is Justice Clarence Thomas of the Supreme Court. Rick and I say in the book that we agree with him less often on many issues than we do with just about any other member of the court. However, we think that he was he saw exactly what the problem was with mismatch, and he saw it pretty early in life. He first, in an interview with the New York Times, talked about how African-American students who he knew personally were harmed by being placed out of their depth academically. He made a similar argument in his dissent in the 2003 University of Michigan Law School case, Grutter versus Bollinger. That's the only Supreme Court opinion in which the subject's ever been mentioned, I believe, the whole question of mismatch. And although I'm afraid a lot of pro-affirmative action types who we hope to reach may have a visceral reaction because they don't like Clarence Thomas, but on this subject, he is well worth reading.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to make something else clear before we move on, and that is that when we talk about placing students, and I'm characterizing what you're saying, so please correct me, when we talk about placing students who are less well-prepared among students who are more well-prepared, we are not disparaging those students who are less well-prepared.
No, we're trying to figure out how to maximize their education.
Yeah.
And a related point, I guess there are two related points. One is that I think when some people first hear this idea, they think that we're suggesting that students receiving preferences just aren't qualified for college, and that the effect of our suggestions would be to reduce college opportunities. And that's not true at all. There are hundreds of terrific colleges in America, but they cover a pretty wide range of spectrum in terms of the competitiveness of their student bodies and the rigor of their curriculum. And the focus of what we're suggesting is that you have to have a better match across that spectrum between students and the environments in which they're ending up in.
Mm-hmm.
In California, where racial preferences were banned by the voters in 1996, the effect of Prop 209 has pretty clearly been to substantially increase Black and Hispanic enrollment at the University of California, the most elite part of California public higher education. It's led to reductions at the very top of that heap. Berkeley and UCLA have fewer Blacks than they did before Prop 209. But those students who were displaced by Prop 2 and I went to less elite schools because racial preferences weren't being used, still ended up in very good schools, mostly UC schools, and ended up getting bachelor degrees and much, much higher rates. Mm-hmm. So the overall degree attainment rate here at the university has skyrocketed.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to point out, you say again and again in the book that these are perfectly intelligent people. They just don't quite have the preparation that other students would. And I know that I've, to wax biographical for a moment, this sort of happened in my own case. I went to a college in the Midwest, and then it was perfect for me. It really was, because I wasn't terribly well prepared for going on, let's say, to graduate school. And I've come to know a lot of people in my academic career who were terribly well prepared, who basically had college degrees before they got college degrees. And I think that, you know, they profited from being at one of these very elite institutions. I think I would have really suffered badly had I gone to one of these places. But I was brought along and, you know, I did just fine. I'm not the brightest bulb on the tree, but, you know, I make a contribution. And I think it's an important thing to point out that you're not saying anything about the native intelligence, whatever that might be, of these people. They're not as well prepared. And you're saying that they are probably more apt to succeed in their life goals if they are put among other students who have similar preparation.
Definitely. Yeah. We would say the same of any student of any race who might be able to get into a university with a large preference. Probably the alumni children tend to get preferences, not as large. Athletes sometimes get very large preferences, and the children of wealthy donors sometimes get very large preferences. If, for example, a friend who was able to give a lot of money to a fancy college to get his child who was not, you know, whose board scores were, say, 300 points below the median at that college, or ask me, should I push for this? I would advise no, for the same reason. Either your child is better off going to a place where he or she is more or less competitive with classmates, no matter what the race of the child. It's just that the racial preference system we have in this country today systematically puts black kids and to some extent Hispanic kids in classes with others who have far better entering preparation, and that's the problem.
Mm-hmm. Rick, yeah. You were going to say?
Yeah, I was just saying, Marshall, that it's really not a question of intelligence at all. It's a question of academic preparation. And a good example is Roland Fryer, who is probably the leading African-American economist in the nation today. He teaches at Harvard now. And he was profiled in the New York Times Magazine about 10 years ago because he had the exact kind of classic disadvantaged story of growing up in a highly dysfunctional family, frequenting public housing, living in very difficult conditions, had a pretty poor K-12 education. But he was a brilliant guy. And he went to a fairly low-tier school, discovered economics, fell in love with it, and started performing brilliantly. So by the time he had finished college, he was well prepared to go to graduate school anywhere. He ended up becoming a junior fellow at Harvard, which is kind of like Harvard's super doctoral program. Mm-hmm. I think he would be the first to agree that was a really good trajectory for him. That had he gone into a really demanding environment as a college freshman, who might easily have been overwhelmed and felt that he couldn't compete in economics.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the evidence. There are a number of, as you say, we'll talk about this in a moment, that the universities are very reticent to give data on outcomes. But there have been a number of natural experiments that have shed a certain amount of light on mismatch. Can you talk a little bit about those? Do you want to start, Rick, and then we can go to Stuart?
Sure. Well, you know, the best natural experiment is the one and that's happened in California since Prop 209 passed in 1996. Because there you can look at what happened immediately before and immediately after racial preferences stopped being used. A group of University of California professors trying to get very detailed data from the university back in 2007 to study this issue. And even though several of us had fairly prominent positions within the UC hierarchy, we were stonewalled for a year. And when the university eventually did give us data, they heavily censored it. They, for example, combined blacks and Hispanics in a single category. They would only give us data for students grouped into three-year cohorts. They took out a lot of information that would have been useful and would have made our research better. Still, what they gave us was probably the best data that any university has given any professors, useful for studying mismatch, that was publicly available in the whole history of this effort. And that data has now produced half a dozen research papers that are coming out in peer-reviewed journals. Pretty clearly, that data has shown, I think, three general things. One is that, as I mentioned before, minority enrollments ended up going up in the UC as a whole rather than down, partly because the University of California, left without the tool of racial preferences, started doing outreach into disadvantaged communities in a way that it never had before. It spent tens of millions of dollars creating partnerships with inner city high schools, trying to get people to take the sort of courses they needed to prepare for the university, helping provide tutoring, and so on. So that led to a dramatic increase in applications from the folks that we really want to reach, which is low to moderate income households, whether they be Black, Hispanic, white, or Asian. And in time, that produced a substantial increase in minority enrollment at the university. Second big effect was that outcomes improved dramatically. So before Prop 2 and on, Blacks at UCLA had a four-year graduation rate that hovered in the mid-teens, around 15, 16, 17%. After 2009, that went up into the 30 to 40% range very quickly, and now it's above 40%. So the overall effect system-wide was for much better outcomes. You not only had more minority students, but those students were getting degrees at a higher rate. They were having much better success persisting in science. They were having higher GPAs. So almost all the academic outcomes were sharply improved. And the third effect, which you can see is linked to the first two, is that Black and Hispanic students started accepting offers from the university at a higher rate than they had before. So a lot of the conventional story told about affirmative action is that it's necessary to help make students feel that there's a welcoming environment, that Black students would be intimidated by elite institutions and would be reluctant to come unless they see visible evidence that the university is aware of race and is deliberately trying to foster a preferential environment for racial minorities. And we found just the opposite, that Black and Hispanic students accepted offers from the university at all UC campuses at substantially higher rates after Prop 2 and 9 than before, which suggested that they really wanted to go to a school where they could feel that they had gotten in on the merits, where they were not going to be stereotyped as the recipients of racial preferences, and where their degrees would be free of any stigma of having not been earned the same way that everyone else earned their degrees. Mm-hmm. So together, those are you know, a pretty convincing case, I think, that mismatch is real and that we can do much better.
Mm-hmm. Stuart?
Yes, and just to telescope a little bit, other evidence, there have been at least four major studies of undergraduate education that have shown, by and large, that African-American students in particular who are put over their heads academically through racial preferences tend to flee the tough courses. A large percentage come in wanting to be scientists, engineers, pre-med, or scholars. And these studies, which have not been rebutted at all, tend to show that they can't hack it in the really tough courses. They tend to go to easier courses, and they don't get to pursue their career ambitions, those who had wanted to be scientists or scholars, professors. Rick mentioned the 1996 study by Rogers Elliott at Dartmouth. Similar results were reached by Fred Smith and John McArdle in a 2004 study, in a 2003 book by Stephen Cole and Eleanor Barber called Increasing Faculty Diversity, which is commissioned by the Ivy League presidents and funded by pro-affirmative action results, but pro-racial preference group, the Mellon Foundation. But Cole and Barber's conclusions were that racial preferences were harming these students and undermining their intellectual self-confidence. Peter Arcidiacono at Duke University and colleagues have done a similar study. And then finally, Rick Sander, my co-author's own studies of law school mismatch have taken a further step because of the bar exam stands as a test of what people learned. Most, when you graduate from undergraduate school, there is really isn't any universal test of what you learned. Mm-hmm. There is something close to that in the form of the bar exam, and Rick's own work shows astonishingly high failure rates on the bar exams, even by African-American students, as compared with white or Asian students who entered law school with the same academic records, same LSAT scores, same grades. And yet there's still this huge differential in the bar exam flunk rate. And I think Rick shows compellingly that the reason is that the black students are, most of them, in law schools where they cannot do well. They get discouraged. They don't learn as much as they would in a somewhat less selective law school. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Just, yep. Marshall, if I can just follow up on Stuart's last point. That finding about law schools has recently been confirmed by an economist named Doug Williams, whose research was accepted last month by one of the leading empirical journals in the field. It's the Journal of Empirical Legal Studies. What's really important about Doug's work is that he examined and compared blacks with other blacks and used a database that where he was able to estimate the size of preference that individual students had received. And he compared blacks who received large preferences with blacks who had been accepted to more elite schools but had chosen, for, say, family reasons or financial reasons, to go to a somewhat less elite school. So what's great about that research is that some of my critics had said, well, you know, we can never really know if what's driving the difference between blacks and whites is mismatch or something else that's correlated with race. Williams' work shows that even when you compare blacks with other blacks at different levels of mismatch, you get the exact same results. Mm-hmm. Dramatically higher success rates for blacks who went to schools where they were somewhat better matched.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a moment in the book where you describe how you explain this particular effect, that is the discouragement which especially racial minorities feel, and you give a kind of hypothetical case of you go into a class and you don't do very well. Can you go through that? Do you remember which one I'm talking about?
Yeah, Stuart, do you want to take that?
Sure. Yeah, the example that we use is a high school math class. Let's say you're a junior in high school. Let's say you're a pretty good math student. Let's say your SATs were 650 or 700. Then suddenly you find yourself put in the special math class from hell, where everyone else in the class, except you and your best friend, you and your best friend are pretty good math students. The other 18 students in the class are math whizzes, math geniuses, 800 SATs. 5 on the advanced placement test are headed that way. They're just a lot better than you are in preparation and perhaps in terms of gifts, but let's stick with preparation for the moment. So they're going to be able to go much faster than you are. The teacher might take 2 weeks to go through a very tough unit of calculus and they get it, but you need a month to get through that tough unit of calculus and really get it. The teacher is moving at a pace designed for the median student in the class and the majority in the class. So after 2 weeks on unit X of calculus, he's on to unit Y of calculus, but you and your best friend are lost because you're not ready to move on, and you'll get progressively more lost as the year passes. Now imagine that you and your best friend who are sitting in this class happen to be black and everyone else in the class happens to be Asian and white. And you get a little bit of the sense of how it might feel in most selective universities in America.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a very telegraphic way to put it. I think it's I think a lot of people have experienced such things. I mean,
in fact, Rick did himself. Why don't you tell about that, Rick, in your language problem?
When I was at Harvard, I had a really good junior year in it and made the mistake of thinking I was invulnerable. So
you're excused. You're only 19.
That's right. Even though I'd always been terrible in foreign languages, I thought, let me give it another shot. So I signed up for a German class at Harvard. And the average Harvard student is very fast with foreign languages. And I found within 3 weeks that I was completely lost and kept thinking that, well, if I work harder and buckle down and do extra hours, I'll catch up. But I kept falling further and further behind. So it was kind of a frightening experience. And that was for someone who, already had a lot of intellectual self-confidence and knew that I was going to graduate anyway. So the stakes weren't that high for me. And you can only imagine how terrifying that would be for someone who didn't have those advantages.
Yeah, no, and especially if you look around the room and you see a lot of people that look like you and they aren't doing well either.
Yeah.
That would be very disturbing, I think. Very, very disturbing. Now, you talk in the book about why academics can't be honest about this, even though I suspect that they know it. Can you talk a little bit about why that is? Why they're so hard to teach in this way?
Well, you know, there are many different motives for different sectors of the academy. For African-American faculty or leaders of say, minority services on campus, the view is that if you attack preferences, you sort of directly undermine their authority on campus, their role on campus, because a lot of their purpose, a lot of their influence on campuses arises from the fact that there are very large minority preferences and therefore large presences on campus. So they see preferences as kind of a direct threat and therefore feel a loyalty to the programs and to one another that I think is largely political. There are other faculty who helped start racial preference programs or who were actively involved with them at some time in their careers. And they feel very sort of attached to these and feel this is one of the most important accomplishments that they had, that, you know, many academics would like to see more social justice in America. And they feel that, well, at least we've created some social justice here on campus. So they also feel intensely protected with these programs because they're so identified with them and they see them as kind of a bulwark against social conservatism.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have administrators who I think very generally see the problems, but feel that anything they would say would be instantly seized upon by others on campus as evidence that they were unfit to rule. You know, there have been a series of sort of spectacular forced admissions of university administrators who said politically incorrect things. So it's almost part of the rule one playbook of being a campus administrator is make sure you are on the right side of the diversity climate in your school. Be proactive in this area. Never appear to be retrenching or to be skeptical about the benefits of diversity. So for them, it's a complete no-brainer. I'm living through all this right now because I talk in the book about, or Stuart, I have a chapter in the book that talks about how UCLA has increasingly turned to explicit racial preferences again. They're kind of backing away from the race neutrality required by Prop 209, and it's pretty clear that they're breaking the law. So when the book came out, that ignited a furor on campus, and sort of these stories have played out in all the usual ways. Our position was really strengthened because several years ago, a few of us questioned whether new admissions programs at UCLA were in fact engaging in racial discrimination, and the university commissioned a distinguished sociologist to do an independent study, and his report came out a few months ago and found that in fact there were large numbers of black admissions on campus that could not be explained by controlling for any of the factors that the university setting used in admissions. So we had this essentially official study completely backing us up. And despite that, there has been an incredible effort by activists on campus, among both faculty and students, and administrators to simply denounce the claim that there's anything discriminatory going on and to completely ignore the evidence, even by their own expert. And an awful lot of faculty who will shake my hand if they run into me in the hallway, and say, you know, keep up the good work, just feel that they cannot say anything public about this.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really easy for those who are denying reality to, send a petition to the president with hundreds of signatures, demanding that no changes be made in admissions.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard to get a petition saying the opposite. So it's a really difficult environment in which to talk about this stuff, honestly.
Mm-hmm. Let me turn to Stuart to ask a follow-up question. You guys also point out that it's difficult for the media and politicians to accept or speak about these issues. Stuart, can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. And I think the media have traditionally portrayed affirmative action / racial preferences as a good thing, and that, you know, that you're virtuous if you support them and that you're somewhat suspect if you don't support them. And in part for that reason, and the media have systematically, I would say, emphasized every positive aspect of the story and buried every negative aspect of this story they can. It comes right down to the terminology, which we talked about before. The media almost never use the phrase racial preferences. And of course, Fox News might. I'm talking about most of the mainstream media. They use the phrase affirmative action, and that's it's a ambiguous and somewhat misleading phrase, because a lot of people think that when you say affirmative action, you're talking about benefits for the disadvantaged, race-neutral benefits of the disadvantaged, or you're talking about Presidents Kennedy and Johnson meant, which was trying really, really hard to open up opportunities to members of all races, when in fact the media know perfectly well that when they say affirmative action, they're talking about racial preferences, but their readers don't all know that. Politicians, I think, are terrified of this issue. Even though most Republicans, at least, and a lot of Democrats I know, have severe doubts about the wisdom of racial preference policies, no national politician has made a strong attack on this policy since at least 1996, when California adopted a ban on racial preferences. They're terrified of it. I've talked to a prominent member of the House leadership, Republican House leadership, and I've asked why are you all so silent about this? And the basic answer was they know they'll be portrayed as racially insensitive at best or racist at worst by the media, by academia, and it's just not worth it to them to take the issue on. I'd just add a footnote on, although the dishonesty and the secrecy I deplore that the universities engage in, I'm sympathetic to them in, at least in two ways. One, they're terrified that without racial preferences, the numbers, the percentages of African Americans and Hispanic Americans at the selective campuses would plunge drastically, which is something I wouldn't want to see, and I can see why they're afraid of it. We can talk about why they think that would happen. Two, the system is such that if I were a university president, I would feel trapped. I would not feel that saying, hey, why don't we experiment with reducing greatly the size of racial preferences or eliminating them on this campus and see what happens? Because what would happen is that the number of African Americans on my campus would go down not just a little bit, not just by half, it would go down by to close to zero. Because all the other campuses would still be using racial preferences, and therefore the people who would be accepted by my race-blind university would also be getting accepted by more prestigious places and would tend to go there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I see. So then academics are not particularly cooperating, and the media is not cooperating, nor are politicians. And you talk a little bit about the Supreme Court, and they aren't exactly making things easier for you either.
We think the Supreme Court may be the only solution to this within the next 100 years or so. I personally, and I think Rick may agree, don't like the Supreme Court on a lot of things to defer to the democratic process. And the arguments made, well, why shouldn't they defer to the democratic process here and let the experts run things? And there's some force to that argument. The reason I find it unconvincing in this context is, for the reasons we discussed and others, there's no reform in sight. There's no constituency for reform in sight. There's a lot of people who doubt this system, but all the people who have power over how the system works are either invested in it or afraid to touch it, and the politicians in the latter case. So if you want to see less harm done to the supposed beneficiaries of affirmative action, the Supreme Court is your best hope. And so we hope, Rick and I think, hope that the court in a currently pending case involving the University of Texas will, we don't urge the court to ban the use of race in admissions, but we do urge the court to make some important reforms.
Mm-hmm. Rick?
Yeah, the last 70 years, the Supreme Court has essentially said that any kind of racial classification requires strict scrutiny. And generally the reason for putting it in that special suspect category is that they feel that race is, you know, first of all, the Constitution prohibits differential treatment based on race. And secondly, that it's frequently easy for the political process to entrench racial favoritism. And most of the cases where the court has taken that on have been, say, from the Old South, where you had Jim Crow and stuff like that. But there have also been cases like Croson, where the city of Richmond had a black majority in the city council and started dispensing favors based on race to black contractors. So we think affirmative action really fits in the purview of what the court needs to be very restrictive about. It needs to be very skeptical of, because it's clear that the political process hasn't worked well in trying to evaluate what's happening with the programs, trying to make available information, trying to have transparency. On all those counts, it's really been a fairly dysfunctional system. That's when we usually expect the court to step in. Mm-hmm. Let me give you one more example, a concrete example of the media problem. The New York Times has had a few stories over the years about the problem of minorities becoming scientists. And, you know, as you know from our conversation in our book, we think that's a big problem too. Clearly, mismatch is one of the central reasons for low minority achievement in science, and one of the reasons why blacks, for example, are very underrepresented among scientists and engineers. The New York Times, in covering this, has never even raised mismatch as a possibility that can affect minorities. They talked about a general issue of students going to schools where they're less well prepared, but they've mostly have focused on whether there's discrimination somewhere. And they highlighted last year a study that of National Science Foundation funding that found that black applicants for NSF funding were getting grants at a lower rate than white applicants. And there was always a lot of circumstantial evidence that was simply because there were differences in the quality of applications from different groups. But they came back, and in December of 2012, they ran another story on this, pointed out that some of the original research on the NSF discrimination was falling apart, and cast doubt on the discrimination story, but still ignored the mismatch issue. This was despite the fact that our book, which had come out 2 months before, specifically criticized the New York Times for not talking about mismatch. Hmm. I have reporter friends at elite journals and newspapers that have said, you know, I really would like to write about this, but I get so much garbage every time I take on this issue that it just isn't worth it for me professionally.
Well, so at the end of the book, you make some proposals about what might be done. Stuart, why don't you begin talking about those, and then we will turn our attention to Rick.
Yeah, we have two major proposals, and then a kind of another one that kind of complements them. The first is total transparency in university racial admissions programs, in the sense that the university should make available to applicants in the first instance, but also to the general public, all the information, all the data that show how their admissions policies work, actually, what the gaps are between various racial groups, for example, in terms of admissions criteria, in terms of newly admitted students, and how well people do academically, either from within, you know, and those could be correlated mainly with their entering credentials. If somebody has an SAT, you know, people have SAT scores of ABC and high school GPAs of whatever. How are those people doing at Princeton or at Harvard or at Georgetown or at GW, so that people who are being accepted with large preferences can get some idea whether they really are likely to do well, as they're generally told, or as the data would show, not so likely to do well. And so, you know, this would be healthy both for as a consumer protection measure for this, for the recipients of preferences, but also as a public policy measure, so that the people who are ultimately responsible for what our public policies are, politicians and voters, as well as university officials, would have all the available data on how all the information that's being hidden should be made public. The second major proposal we have is to subordinate racial identity to socioeconomic disadvantage in terms of who is targeted by affirmative action, or call them preference programs. In particular, we would say that no university should be able to give preferences based on race to affluent kids that are larger than the preferences it's given giving based on socioeconomic factors to less affluent kids. One way it would work is it would disallow what's now universal, which is accepting the children of black doctors and lawyers mm-hmm. ahead of the children of white cab drivers and seamstresses who have higher grades and test scores. Mm-hmm. Part of that, and the third and less important but related thing would be to ban race-based scholarships as opposed to race-based admissions criteria. Race-based scholarships are used more or less by universities to engage in bidding wars to try and get, you know, to try and get the best qualified racial minority students to come to their school. And they really don't increase at all the total number of racial minorities in the universities. They simply channel money towards these bidding wars that would be better invested in promising students who need the money.
Mm-hmm. Rick?
Well, I think Stuart has summed it up quite well. He, you know, the reason why transparency is our central recommendation is that that would set up a whole virtuous cycle of other developments. We now have kind of a negative cycle that's fueled by secrecy. But with transparency, any school that has to make public how students who receive preferences end up doing is going to immediately realize that they have to do one of two things. They either have to provide better academic support for the students they're admitting, or they have to retool their admissions programs. And either of those things would be constructive. Students, clearly, when they are comparing offers of admission, need something better than the U.S. News and World Report to figure out, you know, what are the merits, what are their prospects of these different schools. So transparency creates all sorts of accountability that would be incredibly healthy for the system. And once there's a certain amount of accountability, then debate has to come out in the open. You know, we've had a standing offer for 6 months to post a $10,000 prize for any critic of Mismatch who will have an open debate with us in front of empiricists and let the empiricists judge which side has the better argument. And no one has taken us up. Whenever I do have debates with critics, they usually start out, they're generally non-empiricists, and they'll start out saying, well, I'm going to cite some of the evidence, but I'm not prepared to defend it because I'm not an empiricist. It sounds incredible, but that's happened to me at sort of the two largest debates I've been in recent months. So you now have a situation where the sort of the establishment affirmative action position is to simply not engage with the issue. If there's transparency, then they'll have to engage.
Mm-hmm. Is there any, and either of you can answer this, are there any institutions that are moving toward transparency in this way? It would seem to me, let me just say my own thought on the issue. It would seem to me that sort of less prestigious schools who are doing very well have a lot of, it would serve them very well to release all this data. I can see how the prestigious schools wouldn't want to do it.
Well, the problem with that is the cascade effect. So when the school uses preferences, then they force the second-tier school to make a choice. Either that school can use even larger preferences, or they can have very, very few minority students. And in the current environment, it's just politically impossible for a school to make that second choice. Mm-hmm. So the cascade, as we show in chapter 2 of the book, tends to produce substantially larger preferences as you move from tier one down to, say, tier five schools, say a 200th ranked school would be like a tier five school. Mm-hmm. So there aren't that many counterexamples of schools that can put forth that information. One sort of school that can are the historically black schools, and they have put out a lot of information. And there have been a lot of studies showing that blacks who go to those historically black schools tend to have very good outcomes. But you know, that has not been seized upon by observers or reporters or politicians as something about mismatch. It's seen as something about the environment of those schools. Mm-hmm. So there's been a surprising lack of what you're suggesting.
Yeah. Stuart?
Whenever the data do come to light, and they come to light here and there, almost always over the resistance of the universities who try and keep them secret, they're really quite striking. And the current pending lawsuit, for example, against the University of Texas admission system, we brought to light in a friend of the court brief we filed data showing that for the relevant group of applicants, those admitted outside the so-called top 10% system, the mean SAT score on a scale of 2,400 of Asians was 467 points above the mean black score. The mean white score was 390 points above the mean white score. These are gigantic mm-hmm. Gaps, and they're typical of what goes on around the country from all the evidence we've seen. So, and one thing we should emphasize is if the gaps were small, you know, if it were, say, 50 points on average or maybe even 100 points on average, then the mismatch problem wouldn't be such a big problem because nobody's claiming that, you know, that every SAT point is a huge difference between people who have a little bit fewer, a few more. It's when you have great big gaps like these that the mismatch problem presents itself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we don't even really know whether small preferences are a net harm or a net benefit. The data that's available isn't granulated enough to let us measure that. Mm-hmm. It's possible that if you have a small preference, that you sort of do better because you respond to the challenge and mm-hmm. you have talented peers who can mentor you and things like that. That's something that there ought to be research on. Mm-hmm. But to do that, we have to have better data.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask this as a final question. Ricky, you've already sort of touched on it, but let me ask again. How has your book been received in various quarters?
We've generally been pretty happy. It's gotten a lot of good reviews. There are good Amazon ratings. There's been a fair amount of coverage. And I think that there are signs in a way that I didn't see at all when I started working on this field 7 years ago that some liberal establishment groups are really trying to engage with this. So there have been several organizations that have approached me that I don't think would have talked about mismatch 5 or 6 years ago that want to set up a dialogue. I'm giving a talk to a group called the Philanthropy Roundtable later this year that has many members that are sort of invested in providing grants to education. And they want to know sort of if mismatch is true, how should that modify their kind of educational mm-hmm. strategies? So developments like that, I think, are really encouraging. Mm-hmm. On the discouraging side is that most of the standard liberal outlets, like the New York Times and the New York Review of Books and the New Yorker, have pretty much ignored the book, when I don't think they would ignore a book that had a similar level of kind of public policy reach and empirical detail, but came out and argued that affirmative action was a good thing. I mean, if you compare the reception of the New York Times to our book with what it accorded The Shape of the River when that came out in 1998, it's like night and day. Mm-hmm. So there's still a tendency by a lot of the standard organs to just, you know, pretend that this issue isn't there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Stuart?
Yeah, I agree, and I'd emphasize, you know, I think it's kind of shocking, frankly, that a book that's been treated as important by a lot of important people, including those who wrote blurbs for us, including some fairly liberal people, has been totally ignored by the New York Times. It'd be one thing if they wrote a review that said, well, here's why this book is unconvincing, but they haven't taken that. The people who have attacked our logic have been longtime critics of Ricks, by and large, and then some other people they apparently recruited who wrote in front of the court briefs in the Supreme Court responding to our brief and are starting to write in reviews. Very complicated attacks on the statistical methodology underlying some of the conclusions, mainly the ones from Rick's earlier work on law schools. While presenting these critiques as though they kind of were discrediting our entire work, they really are aimed exclusively, almost exclusively, at Rick's law school work. There are recycled versions of critiques that Rick responded to compellingly, I thought, several years ago. And they continue to ignore all the other studies we've mentioned that show problems with mismatch that nobody has ever even attempted to refute.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, why don't we just talk a moment about sort of the general critique and respond to a couple of
Please, go ahead.
I think, you know, when my original piece came out on law school mismatch, there was actually, you know, there was actually an organized effort to refute it. There was a meeting at the American Association of Law Schools convened for people who were concerned about the article and planning how to respond to it. And there were about 20 critiques that were published within within about a year and a half of the publication of my piece. And no published article that supported it. So the critics were pretty happy because they thought that they had sort of shown that the establishment was firmly rejecting this conclusion, including a lot of distinguished empiricists. And then an effort started to look more closely at some of the findings of those. And we challenged one prominent critic to sort of show the numbers behind her results. And it turned out that the results didn't really exist. And the journal that published the critique had to withdraw it and apologize. And a new article running the same numbers showed exactly the effects that mismatch predicted. Then there was the Williams piece that I mentioned has just been accepted, which goes through each of the critics and essentially shows that if you make proper adjustments, reasonable adjustments for biases in the data, if you do the tests using all the information available instead of a subset of the information, then the results are very strongly supportive of mismatch. So a lot of those early critiques have now been discredited. Therefore, an awful lot of the current critiques basically draw on that 2005-2006 literature. Oh, hang on a second. Let me go. And instead of sort of advancing a particular argument, they say, well, there's a clear consensus rejecting the mismatch argument. In other words, the current literature almost entirely relies on the earlier consensus as evidence against mismatch, instead of talking about the evidence at all. And that actually seems to be very encouraging because it means that these guys have run out of ideas. Mm-hmm. They're sort of hoping that people will not look too closely and will just say, well, you know, if you just count the number of critiques, then that seems like there's room for doubt.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I'd say the main current critique by some serious empiricists is that, and this was made in the Supreme Court brief that they filed, was that policymakers should not act on mismatch until there are randomized experiments showing that mismatch exists. In other words, that the quality of evidence behind mismatch is not comparable to the quality of evidence we have for, say, testing a new medicine or a scientific theory. You know, we haven't done controlled experiments, and that's perfectly true. But the response to that is threefold. One is that if the only social science out there was based on controlled experiments, then social sciences would have very little to do because there aren't that many controlled experiments involving humans. In fact, there are a lot of federal regulations saying that you can experiment with humans in many ways. So controlled experiments is an awfully high bar to set. The second is that we do have some pretty good quasi-experimental evidence, like we talked about before with Prop 2 and 9 and with this evidence on blacks who choose to go to different tiers of law schools for different reasons and looking at their academic results. So the kind of evidence we have is actually dramatically stronger than the sorts of evidence that supporters of affirmative action think is fine when they when they're talking about other issues. And the third is that if universities would sort of at least admit that this was a potential problem and would try to set up controlled experiments, we'd be totally for that.
Mm-hmm.
We are leading the charge for it.
Mm-hmm.
So we think that the critiques are really kind of hollow, and it's a sign of weakness, but it's also disappointing that they're even, you know, given credence by any kind of mainstream outlet.
Mm-hmm. Footnote to that, by and large, the same people who like to criticize some of our work, Rick's work in particular, as based on insufficient data, are frantically doing everything they can to make sure no data come out.
Yeah.
that might prove or disprove some of these points. There's in particular a lawsuit Rick's involved in against the California Bar, which is trying to conceal the data that would enable a much more definitive test, one way or another, of the correctness of Rick's earlier conclusions and the people attacking them. The people attacking them are happy to complain that his data aren't sufficient to prove his point, but also very eager to make sure he doesn't get any more data.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, so actually sort of led the charge to stop the California Bar from releasing the data. There was a point. This database basically has Nate's data from something like 200,000 people who have taken the California Bar in the last 30 years. And it's the kind of granulated data I mentioned before that would let us see whether small preferences have positive or negative effects.
Mm-hmm.
And it would also be a much more dramatic sort of way of looking at one of the effects of mismatch in particular law schools. And a whole series of prominent critics basically filed specious arguments saying that the data shouldn't be released. Mm-hmm. Sometimes just advancing ridiculous arguments for the purpose of saying that there were serious scholars who thought the data shouldn't come out.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually gave the bar a pause, and they were eventually persuaded to turn us down and defend a lawsuit on whether the data should be disclosed. Currently, we've won that suit at the California Appellate Court level, and it's on appeal to the California Supreme Court. It's hard for institutions to defend this sort of complete lack of transparency. So we're optimistic we're going to win that. We've actually gotten a lot of the establishment media to sign a brief that's on our side.
Mm-hmm.
So things like that, I think, are ultimately very encouraging and tend to discredit the critics.
Mm-hmm. Well, Rick Sander and Stuart Taylor, I want to thank you for being on the New Books Network today. We were talking about mismatch, how affirmative action hurts students, it's intended to help, and why universities won't admit it. I'm Marshall Poe, the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network and the host of New Books and Big Ideas. I hope everybody has a great week.
You too, Marshall. Thanks very much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Marshall, bye-bye.